This free program is paid for by the listener sponsors of WORT, Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. If you haven't already, please consider donating online to help keep Radio of the Free alive.
November 19th, when we talk to UW-Madison's Emily B. Sessa about ferns and some surprising new results concerning their family trees, about science blogging, and about the upcoming 150th anniversary of Charles Darwin's masterpiece, The Origin of Species. That's 7 p.m., Thursday, November 19th. On the Perpetual Notion Machine, here on WORT 89.9 FM.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, a locally owned and operated internet, digital phone, direct TV, and low-voltage wiring provider for multi-dwelling communities and businesses. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608- 663-3868.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. No power frequency.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. You know, just the past couple of days, I was glancing, on Tuesday, I was glancing at the New York Times, all the news that fits we print, and came across a couple of items that kind of tie in neatly to our program today. Headline, buried, of course, way A21, 49 million Americans report a lack of food. The number of Americans who lived in households that lacked consistent access to adequate food soared last year to 49 million, the highest since the government began tracking what it calls food insecurity 14 years ago. This, according to the Department of Agriculture on Monday, the increase of 13 million Americans was much larger than even the most pessimistic observers of hunger trends had expected, and cast an alarming light on the daily hardships caused by the recession's punishing effect on jobs and wages. About a third of these struggling households suffered what the researchers called very low food security, the most severe form measured, meaning lack of money forced some members to skip meals, cut portions, or otherwise forgo food at some point during the year. The other two-thirds typically had enough to eat, but only by eating cheaper or less varied foods, relying on government aid like food stamps or visiting food pantries and soup kitchens. Then on page A17, again, the Tuesday New York Times, employers and workers routinely underreport work-related injuries and illnesses, calling into question the accuracy of nationwide data that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration compiles each year, this according to the Government Accountability Office. The report by the GAO, the auditing arm of Congress, said many employers did not report workplace injuries and illnesses for fear of increasing their workers' compensation costs or hurting their chances of winning contracts. The report also said workers did not report job-related injuries because they feared being fired or disciplined and worried that their co-workers might lose rewards like bonuses as part of safety-based incentive programs. The GAO's report cited several academic studies that found that OSHA data failed to include up to two-thirds of all workplace injuries and illnesses. Again, none of that on the front page of all the news that fits we print. And then a final little squib here. Continuing unemployment is predicted by Fed chief. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben S. Bernanke, warned on Monday that high unemployment and a continued reluctance by banks to make loans were likely to slow the economic recovery for the next year. With me on the phone from Colorado is our guest today, Michael D. Yates, writer, editor, educator. Among his books are Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate, An Economist's Travelogue, Naming the System, Inequality, and Work in the Global Economy, Why Unions Matter, and In and Out of the Working Class. more recently. He has also published more than 150 articles. He is currently associate editor of Monthly Review magazine. He taught economics and labor relations at the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown from 1969 until his retirement in 2001. He currently teaches courses for workers at the University of Indiana, Cornell, the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Yates has also worked in the research office of the United Farm Workers, Farm Workers Union, and has served as a labor arbitrator with the Pennsylvania Bureau of Mediation. Yates grew up in Ford City, Pennsylvania, the son of industrial workers and the working class, and he's co-author of the just-released, co-author with Fred Magdoff, of the just-released The ABCs of the Economic Crisis, What Working People Need to Know. Michael Yates, welcome to Public Affair in WORT.
Oh, thanks, Alan. Good to be here.
Good, good. I'm glad you can make it today. Let's jump right into this, your recent book, The ABCs of the Economic Crisis, What Working People Need to Know. What do working people need to know about this current economic crisis?
Well, you could sum it up pretty quickly. The first thing they need to know is that these kinds of crises are kind of built into the economic system. And there's really, I don't think, any way to avoid them. Now, they're going to vary in terms of the degree of their seriousness, and this is a particularly serious one. But should the economy get back on track a little bit? Should we begin to experience like 3-4% growth rates and a moderation in unemployment? That's not going to last indefinitely. Sooner or later, there'll be another crisis. And the way the government's responded to this one, probably sooner rather than later. And the second thing that working people need to know is that the government, as currently structured, is not on their side. It does not care about their well-being or welfare. And its response to the economic crisis has been to give hundreds of billions of dollars to the very people who generated the crisis in the first place, setting the stage for continued inequality in wealth and income, for continued inequality in political power, and for the and setting the stage for a new economic crisis. So I think those are the two main things. And the third thing, of course, is just as main, is that working people have got to get organized collectively, and the labor movement, as currently structured, is not about to do that.
Take that a little.
Now, you see, those three things would be three things that working people would be well advised to know.
Let's start with the third. That is the labor movement, as currently structured, is not capable of really mobilizing folks for the fight back. Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of really kind of complicated reasons for that. I think the main reason goes back a long way, and that is a long time ago, 50 years ago, the labor movement threw the left wing of the labor movement out. The cutting edge of the labor movement, the group of people, the people who had organized the great industrial unions of the 1930s, the people that were most in the forefront of the struggle against racial oppression and inequality, the very people who were opposed to imperialism of U.S. foreign policy, and the very people who had also negotiated the very best contracts for industrial workers were booted out of the labor movement. And the labor movement has never really recovered from that. It entered in the 1950s into a long period of cooperation with employers, of bureaucratization, and that has just grown and festered and petrified the labor movement in a sense of like petrified wood. And so you take something like healthcare, for example. That's a good example, I think. The nation badly needs universal health care. I mean, it needs that as badly as anything, because that would so much improve the security of the working class and give them the ability to fight against their employers better, because they wouldn't have to worry about that. They wouldn't have to worry about losing. You mentioned that article about safety, and workers are afraid to report safety violations because they're afraid they're going to lose their jobs. Well, another thing they might be afraid of is that they're going to lose their health care, and that's an absolute catastrophe and disaster if that happens to you in the United States and you need to have health care. Now, this is a crying need, and yet still, how long did it take the labor movement to be in favor of single payer even? Why can't the labor movement mobilize millions of people to take to the streets, have one-day strikes, have whatever it takes to get it? I know a friend of mine who works for one of the better unions in the country has been a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. for about 20 years now. He's one of the dean of labor lobbyists. He's the political director of this union. And he says, and I have no reason to doubt him, that the health bill that comes out is going to be worse than the health care we have now. Now, you tell me what kind of labor movement it is that can't mobilize masses of people to fight for something so important as health care. So that just gives you an example of what I'm talking about. We have a new president of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, and he's got a reputation as being some sort of militant. But that reputation was forged 20 years ago. He's been waiting around for 13 years, living pretty dang well down in Washington, D.C., for John Sweeney to either die or retire. Now he's taken leadership of the AFL-CIO, and he's made a lot of promises, but we'll see. I'm really skeptical, because no one wants to mobilize the rank and file. No one wants to empower the rank and file. Nobody gives a dang about democracy in the labor movement. And that's really a key in terms of worker fight back, it seems to me.
You're listening to Michael Yates, associate editor of Monthly Review and the author of numerous titles on working class economics, the labor movement, and more recently, of course, writings on the current crisis. In your introductory remarks, Michael, you talked about those that cause the current downturn, the collapse of the speculative bubble and so on. You're a longtime associate of Monthly Review, and the historically the editors going back to Baron and Sweezy, and then Harry Magdoff, your co-author's dad, and so on, have talked about the deeper structural reasons for such deep recessions, stagnation. Talk about that a little bit, please.
Well, the basic idea of the Monthly Review School of Crisis, I mean, there are a number of radical notions that go back to Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels about the nature of crises and how they're built into the structure of a capitalist economy. That is, a capitalist economy cannot continue to grow and expand without periodic breaks and crises. That crises are endemic or internal to the system. But the Monthly Review argument is, it's pretty straightforward. They say that as it's in the interest of businesses to eliminate competition as much as they can, so that the normal tendency of a capitalist economy will be towards monopolistic, or as the economists call them, oligopolistic markets, in which a few relatively large firms dominate the market and use that domination to have a lot of control over the prices, so that you don't get the kind of thing that you had in the 19th century in the United States, where you'd have periodic, you'd have a good deal of competition, price cutting, deflation, you know, constant falls in prices. I think prices in the United States fell for the last third of the 19th century. And that's, since the 19th century, that's certainly not the case. Prices tend to rise, not fall, with some exceptions. So if you have a system where you have very large firms able to set their prices, and at the same time better able to control their costs, they have research firms, tremendous amounts of money that they can utilize to reduce their costs and put pressure on their suppliers to reduce their costs and expand around the globe in search of low-cost inputs and low-cost production. Well, then that's going to be a system where there's a tendency for the amount of profit, or what the Monthly Review School calls surplus, to rise over time. Now, the surplus is seeking outlets. You know, it doesn't want to be idle. Now, if it can find outlets in investment, that is, what I mean by investment is the production of machinery and equipment and buildings, then the economy can continue to grow. But the very same forces that give rise to that rising surplus also tend to retard investment opportunities. That is, you have very large firms with very large accumulations of capital, fixed capital, buildings, equipment, machinery, and they don't want to spend the money to replace these until they wear out. And so, so instead of there being a constant revolutionizing of production, in terms of destroying old capital and putting in new, you tend to have that old capital in operation until it wears out, and that limits the amount of investment opportunities in the economy. You already have a lot of fixed capital; you don't need as much more as you did before. So the surplus can't find outlets, and unless it does, then the economy slows down or stagnates. Sometimes I don't like the word stagnation; I'd rather say slow growth. It's not that the economy doesn't grow at all, it's just that it doesn't grow very rapidly. And that seems to be the tendency in the United States, with the exception of that recently, that period after World War II, where there was a lot of destroyed capital in the world. The United States was the only economic power. Our export industries boomed. Consumers had a lot of savings from the war that they spent on consumer goods, and so there was a big boom in the economy. That came to an end in the middle of the 1970s, and we've been grappling, or the powers that be have been grappling ever since with ways to re-stimulate the economy. Now, in response to that stagnation or that slow growth that started to hit the economy again in the middle of the 1970s, the powers that be, the employers and their allies in government, engineered what's come to be known as neoliberalism, which basically took away any controls on their capacity to move their money around the world and to make money. And it was an all-out attack on labor unions and working class living standards. And that globalization, for example, and that neoliberalism brought with it the need for new kinds of financial instruments to protect businesses against the risk of doing a political turmoil in other countries, or to protect businesses from risks when the exchange rates of currencies change in ways that harm their they've already done something, and then the currency price changes and causes them to lose money. That caused there to be an invention of new financial instruments to take care of this risk. Well, then you had this tremendous amount of surplus that needed an outlet, and at the same time you had new financial instruments being invented. That sort of gradually led towards the movement of this surplus into the financial sector of the economy. And since the 70s, the financial sector of the economy has grown by leaps and bounds, making a tremendously increased share of the total profits of the economy are going into financial establishments. And, of course, that set the stage then, because once you have all that money going into finance, then the financial sector has an incentive to invent ever new financial instruments. And, of course, you know, you get various kinds of financial bubbles, the high-tech bubble of the late 1990s and early 2000s, then the real estate bubble recently. When these collapse, then, of course, you have the disasters that we're having right now. And that's sort of the basic idea. You have a lot of surplus chasing too few investment opportunities. That surplus has to find an outlet. One of the outlets has been in the financial sector of the economy, and so you have an explosion of finance.
So you,
and that's the main idea.
Also, of course, a kind of speculation entirely divorced or largely divorced from improving or increasing productive capacity, and affecting the working people.
Exactly. That's the point. I mean, there aren't enough profitable investment outlets. Now, from the society's point of view, there could be lots of investment outlets. You know what I'm saying? In other words, we
sure
could have low-cost, efficient housing for everybody instead of the garish kind of suburbs and exurbs we see all around the country in the United States with ever bigger houses and what have you. Those are profitable. But we could have relatively low-cost, not-so-profitable housing financed publicly. That would allow everybody to live decently. That could be more energy efficient and so on. But see, that outlet for the surplus isn't viable given the politics, given the power structure of the country. And you could say the same thing about health care. You could say the same thing about a lot of things.
Mass transit.
The food thing you mentioned.
Right.
The poor nation of Cuba has managed to give its people a basic food basket every month since the revolution in 1959. There's no reason why the United States couldn't do much better than that. But it's not profitable, so it doesn't happen. So there are a lot of outlets for the surplus, it's just that they're not profitable outlets. Businesses are looking for profitable outlets. If the profit is in finance, if the profit is in, you know, packaging, repackaging, and re-repackaging mortgages, and selling those new kinds of financial instruments, derivatives of one kind or another all around the world, then that's what they're going to do. It's not socially productive. It's socially useless, and as we've learned now, it's socially destructive. And that's what's so galling. If you see Goldman Sachs, for example, or if you see AIG, what social use do these people have? I would say close to zero. They don't do anything socially productive, yet they get all this money, and the bailout money is all gone to them. And it's just so outrageous that you'd think people would be upset about it and angry about it. You'd think the labor movement would get its mobilize what forces it has and try to expand those forces to really protest, and instead we get these teabaggers.
Of course, you know, during the election campaign that led to, of course, the ascendancy of Barack Obama, there was a lot of conversation, a lot of discussion on the left within labor and outside the labor movement about the need, of course, to get rid of the Bush-Cheney crowd. Oh, do we lose him? Did we lose Michael Yates there? We'll get back. We'll reconnect momentarily. We don't know what happened. But what I was saying, of course, is that the lots of folks said, well, we got to get behind Barack Obama, understandably, but then we'll have to push him when he gets elected through mobilizations from below, and that isn't taking place. And I want to get back to Michael Yates and have him address that. In the meantime, we'll open up the phone lines here, get Michael back very shortly, but people feel free to call 256-2001 with your questions and comments about the current economic situation and the labor movement and how it impacts working class lives. If people want to call in and talk about the ways in which it's affecting you, give us a call, 256-2001. Do we have him back? Michael,
I'm
I don't
back,
know.
Alan.
Good, good. And I don't know what happened there.
You were talking about Barack Obama.
Yeah, no. The point, of course, is that people in the labor movement, people in labor in the left in the labor movement said, well, we got to get behind this guy because, A, either he's really an ally, or B, we'll push him, make demands on him, will mobilize in order to make sure he carries out the progressive parts of his agenda, and that mobilization doesn't appear to be taking place. Talk about that.
Well, first off, I think it's just incredible how gullible people in the liberal left can be. Why would you think that anybody who has gotten to the point where he can run or she could run for president of the United States, that they haven't been so vetted by the people that give them all that get them going, that they're nothing to fear? How rare was it that Franklin Roosevelt actually turned in part on the background from which he came, on the aristocratic, on the big bankers and the capitalists, and actually said he relished their hatred of him? Today you can't even imagine that kind of thing happening. Now, do I think Obama was a better choice than John McCain? Well, yes, but that's like the lesser of two evils kind of argument. And the thing that's really galling is that the labor movement spent well in excess of $100 million on the election of Barack Obama. That's money that could have been spent to hire organizers, to mobilize rank and file, to try to reinvigorate the labor movement. Instead, they did that, and what have we got in return? The Employee Free Choice Act seems to be a dead letter. The health care package, is going to be worse than what we have now. I'm almost ready to collect to get on Medicare. Good luck to me, huh? Because a lot of it's going to be paid by reducing health care to the elderly. That's for sure. That's what it sounds like anyway. A recent report came out. So the thing to have done was to mobilize forces. Don't wait till this guy gets elected and then say we've got to mobilize forces to get him to move our way. He's not going to move our way ever. It's not going to happen. Look at Afghanistan. Do you need any more proof than that? I mean, there is a sinkhole beyond sinkholes. $1 million a year for each soldier in Afghanistan. For what? What, is there about 100 al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan? If that, they could wage war against the United States from any point in the globe. We're going to bring democracy to Afghanistan? I mean, don't make me laugh. That's just a joke. All we're going to do is kill a bunch of people in Afghanistan and have our soldiers killed as well. So, and Obama is going to send the troops. He doesn't even have the courage to stand up for that. He's a good talker, but that's about all he is, best I can tell.
256-2001. Of course, you raise by touching into those imperial wars abroad, perhaps one sector of the economy that has growth going on, the stimulus to military spending and these corporations that suckle at the teat of all of that government largesse. The Monthly Review School, of course, has touched on that, going back to Brown and Sweezy's monopoly capital of the mid-60s, the function of military spending. Some people argue that that's the raison d'etre, the reason for what we're witnessing today in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. Comments?
Well, I think that there's some truth to that in the sense that some of the motivation for that is to maintain the strength and the dominance of the United States, of its employing class, to maintain the strength and dominance of that class and the power of the United States as a political and economic entity. So I think there's some truth to that. But we can get carried away with that kind of an argument and miss that there's a lot of irrationality, there's a lot of insanity, there's a lot of graft, corruption, theft involved in all this military spending too. And sometimes that can get out of hand and be counterproductive, even to the interests of the business elite in the United States. I saw recently that the Iraqi government is really discouraging U.S. capitalists from making investments in their country, and a lot of other non-U.S. companies are getting in on the ground floor, such as it be. I mean, we've taken one of the great civilizations of the world in Iraq and ruined it, destroyed it, brought it to its knees, put rubble in the place of antiquities and what have you. So the chances of Iraq getting out of its quagmire anytime soon is pretty small. And we've done that. The United States has complete and total responsibility for that, it seems to me. And we're doing the same thing in Afghanistan. I mean, there's a country run by drug traders. The president's own brother is deeply involved in the drug trade. He grew up in the United States, didn't he? I mean, he was educated here. I mean, he's almost not even an indigenous Afghan. The whole thing is, I mean, on the one hand, you can say there's some grand plan here, and maybe it'll come to fruition, and maybe that was the motivation for it, and that's probably true. But if you look at what's happened on the ground, just a social catastrophe.
Not only that, but
look at all the soldiers that are coming back here. They're maimed and brain damaged and physically damaged, and just think of the child abuse, the spousal abuse, the suicides, the murders that are going to occur because of that. You wonder why this society is so violent. Well, how could you imagine a society that's been at war for the last 100 years wouldn't be?
256-2001. You're listening to Michael Yates, author of the ABCs, co-author of the ABCs of the Economic Crisis. What Working People Need to Know, associate editor of Monthly Review. You kind of alluded there to this kind of giant kleptocracy that is sold to working class folks as democracy, as the bearer of truth and light and freedom to the rest of the world. In your recent article with Fred Magdoff in the Monthly Review, you talk about how the current economic policy is subservient to the same financial interests that brought us the current sorry state in the first place. That a return to normalcy would mean what? Is that what working class folks should be demanding? That we get back to the pre-crisis situation?
Well, I mean, I think that would be a big mistake, because even if you think about the economy, say in the middle of 2006 when the housing market was at its peak, there was still a good deal of unemployment in the economy. If you look at wages in the United States, they've been stagnating for 30 some years. If you look at the power that working people have on the job, you talked about the health and safety on the job, dead letter, OSHA. A dead letter. You look at all the overwork. You have nurses working 12, 14 hours a day. What kind of patient care are they giving people? You look at the restaurant industry. You look at all the service sector industries. You got people that are maiming themselves at work. Is that the kind of society we want to go back to? There's maximum insecurity in the United States. We travel around the country a good deal. And you can walk down streets in any town in the country, no one says hello to you. You could be out on a hiking trail and be alone, and unless they're European, the chances of them saying hello to you are limited. You got maximum alienation in this country. You got no health care. Your housing stinks. Jobs leave an awful lot to be desired. Employers think they're offering you what did I read the other day? A job someplace, a manufacturing job, $13 an hour. Thousands of people applied for the job. That happens everywhere. $13 an hour. If you multiply that out by 2,000 hours a year, that's $26,000. What's that? That's nothing. You can't support a family on $26,000. You're not very well anyway. So is that what we want to go back to? I mean, I was lucky enough to grow up and be white in the 1950s and early 1960s. And my father had a unionized factory job, and so, you know, we did relatively well, but not great, not by any stretch of the imagination. My horizons were so limited when I was young, it's hard to imagine now. It's hard to even think about it. I feel cheated every day, and my wife feels cheated every day about the things we didn't learn, the things we didn't know, the things we weren't exposed to. Is that the kind of thing we want to go back to? Everybody has the right as a human being to develop their full capacity. If that's never going to happen in a country like this. We get back to normal, whatever that means. So what Fred and I tried to raise in that chapter that was reprinted in the last issue of the Monthly Review was that we ought to be rethinking what our priorities are, try to think what kind of a society we would like to have, and fight tooth and nail for that, not for crumbs in the table, but the table.
256-2001, I'm happy to say we have a number of people waiting on the phone to get in with their comments and questions for Michael Yates. Let's go to the first caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, is that me?
That is.
All right, then. I think you're right on with the class analysis and... you know, as it says in the preamble of the IWW, the working class and the ruling class have nothing in common. And the ruling class is that class of monopoly capitalists. And as you pointed out, Barron and Sweezy made a really cogent argument that capitalism tends towards monopoly. And because of that... the things that we think of as being irrational actually are not irrational. Part of it is planned, but for instance, racism is not necessarily irrational because people believe that they have this need, and they are taught that they're not going to get that need met unless they assert their white skin privilege.
A question for our guest, please.
Yeah, so talk about that a little more.
Well, I guess what I would say is this: what I think you mean is that what's private, what's rational inside of this system, is one thing. What's socially rational, you know, what's rational from the point of view of the maximum well-being of the people in the society, are really two different things. If I have white skin privilege, so for most white people, are they going to take advantage of that in one way or another, whether they consciously take advantage of it or whether they just get an advantage from it? Well, of course, they probably are. They probably are going to do that. So in that sense, it's rational from their self-interested point of view. But if we imagine things from a social point of view as opposed from a point of view inside of a system like ours, where it's every man, woman, and child for himself and herself. And those are really two different things. And what Fred and I tried to do was to, you know, try to look at things from what might be socially rational. I mean, those are hard arguments to make in a society like this, of course, because recently we were checking out on Facebook. With a comment that somebody made, and there happened to be a former student of mine, and she was really irate because at the local grocery store, people that had the Advantage card, you know, where they're getting some access card. I'm sorry, where they get some public assistance. That if they spend money in this store, they also get the fuel advantage from the gas station at the store. You know, if you spend so much money, you get a 10-cent a gallon discount. And she was irate as can be about this. Now, what is it with these poor degenerate people that are spending their money on trash? Not only are they getting money for nothing from the government, but they're also getting an advantage from when they buy the gas. And I thought, my goodness gracious, could you start to look at things from a social point of view instead of this insane, selfish point of view? You understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
That seemed perfectly rational, the argument that she was making, but I thought it was insane. I mean, insane, completely insane.
Instead of looking down
at the people that have nothing, she should be looking up at the people that have everything and saying, well, why isn't that shared out?
I want to get back to that.
A good point the caller's making.
Yeah, I want to get back to that comment you made about why accept the crumbs off the table when we not get the entire table. But we do have callers on the line. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
That me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi.
Yeah, I love your comments. I've been reading a lot of stuff like this. Buckminster Fuller pointed out, yeah, a lot of stuff between constructive economies and destructive economies, of course, and he actually worked for the Pentagon for a while. And I really do see the 600-pound gorilla is the Pentagon, because if you look at 2% of our dollars goes to big government in the form of Pentagon, then where's the, and then the gentleman for the male society, honor and integrity seem to be important. So I can see how prostituted soldiers are taking their lives, and they're not guardians of peace. And how would you, I guess, where's the next alpha dog? Where's a spiritual warrior? I mean, I guess I see that's such a huge change for the whole economy and the military. And what we do as work and duty is really so important to, I don't know, my heart and soul. So how do you see it?
Well, I think you're right. I think the military is so embedded in our society that it just has to be root and branch destroyed, basically. But you see, when it gets so infiltrated into the society, then brings us back to what the first caller said. What's socially irrational is privately rational. Okay, I worked for a long time in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. The congressperson from Johnstown, Pennsylvania is John Murtha. Some of you probably heard of him. And John Murtha has brought hundreds of millions of dollars into that area through defense contract, through the FBI, and what have you. If he were to die and no more money came in, that economy would be devastated, I can guarantee it. So do you think the people in Johnstown are going to be opposed to military spending? I don't think so. That's why you have to have a mass movement based upon working people, I think, since that's the largest group of people, since that's the one thing we all have in common is that we're workers. And slowly and patiently, by arguing and agitating and organizing, create the climate where new possibilities are rational or seem rational or look like they could they could work. And I don't know of any other way to do it. Now here again, the labor movement. What can you say? I mean, they should be so opposed to this war in Afghanistan, and yet you just keep hearing this stuff about support the troops. Well, I want the troops home, but I certainly don't support what the troops are doing in Afghanistan, because what the troops are doing in Afghanistan is what the troops did in Iraq and Vietnam. They're murdering people. Let's be honest about it. That's what soldiers are trained to do, to kill people, period. They're not trained to win hearts and minds. They're trained to kill people. And I feel bad that they're in a circumstance where they have to do that. I feel bad that we have an economic system that drives poor people into the military, because that looks like the only alternative. But on the other hand, I'm opposed to what they're doing. I'm opposed to war. I'm opposed to all this military stuff. Surely Johnstown, Pennsylvania could find better and more constructive ways to build prosperity than to base it upon military spending. But I don't see any way to get around that except through constant organizing and agitating as best you can. It's a tough road to hoe in the United States, because after all, this is the imperialist power. People have a lot of arrogance in the United States. They take things for granted. They believe what they're told in the newspapers. Anytime there's a, you know, if the United States were to invade Iran today, the majority of people would support that invasion. Now, over time, they might come to oppose it as they start to see the dead bodies coming back. But they would be in favor of it right now. So this is a tough nut to crack, that military nut.
256.
I think.
256, 2001. Again, let's go back to the phone lines. We'll continue on with the phone lines for a moment here. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. I think everything you say is absolutely true. The healthcare thing especially is a big hoax, and this is going to be, I think, unconstitutional. People are going to have to pay much more than they do now, only they'll be forced to pay. They won't be able to try to keep themselves healthy. And I think this whole thing is just a payback by Obama and Congress members for all the multi-million dollar, you know, bonuses they've been getting from the health industry. But what, I haven't read your book, but I'd like to know what people, you know, is it going to take a 10 human being march in Washington? I mean, what can we do now? Everybody knows the whole thing, the whole system is just completely fouled up, absolutely fouled up. But what do you recommend? You know, do you have specific recommendations? And also, we don't have any leaders at this point, really. Like, when the Crandon Mine fight got started, there was a guy named Walt Brissett. He was an Indian leader in northern Wisconsin, and he managed to really get people together, you know, of every ilk. But I don't see any, and Gorbachev, in refusing to stop independence movements really was responsible for the demise of the Soviet Union. It certainly wasn't Reagan. But where are the real leaders now? I mean,
caller?
You know, both visionaries and strong guys and gals.
Michael Yates, what is to be done, Michael Yates?
Well, there aren't any too many. The first thing, I just want to make a brief comment. She said paybacks. I bet you if the average citizen in the United States was to go to Washington, D.C. and see that every single day there are scores of lobbyist meetings and luncheons and dinners every single night. There are hundreds of them. You can't get an expensive hotel room in Washington, D.C. right now because they're all taken up by lobbyists. If the person could see how those things are done, it would just be appalling to the average citizen because you'd see you had really no chance in the matter. Now, the caller asked, well, what can be done? And of course, that's a 64 million zillion gazillion dollar question. And if I knew exactly what was to be done, well, then I'd probably be the leader of that mass movement. But I think that all we can do right now is in whatever little bailiwick we are in to do whatever agitation that we can. And when there's a larger group of agitators, join hands with that group. Do the best that we can in the circumstances in which we find ourselves. Every little bit helps. Every letter to the editor, every protest march, every demonstration in the street, every union card that you sign, you spread the word, you make demands on your neighbors, et cetera, to do something, to take heed and take an action. And gradually that starts to build up into something larger. But one of the things that we have to do, I think, is to, for our labor leaders, for example, is to hold their feet to the fire and have them stand on some principle. The right stands on principle, crack-brained as those principles might be. And they've done that since Goldwater in the 60s. And they eventually achieved a great deal of power and a great deal of cohesion, breaking apart now, hopefully, though we're not sure. But their ideas are commonplace now. The government is not about to abandon neoliberalism. Obama, it doesn't make any difference who the president of the United States is. We need counter ideas. Fred and I tried to point out some of these ideas, some of these stronger principles, and that's what we need to agitate for and fight for. Don't take crumbs. Demand the whole table all the time, and then maybe you'll get some crumbs because they'll be afraid of you, like in the 1930s. At least that. Push for alternatives to this system.
Talk about
whenever you can. If you're at dinner with somebody and they're making some comment, make an opposition comment. Don't be afraid. At the grocery store, in church, wherever. I have to admit, sometimes I'm afraid to do that because the system is so powerful and I've been so indoctrinated from my childhood not to speak out and not to protest. But you have to make yourself do that at every level. And it's, you know, big fires are started by little sparks. And that's what I encourage everybody to do, everybody that's listening. Take wherever you're at. Take a stock. Write it down on a piece of paper. What organizations are you in? What could you say? What do you stand for? And go from there.
You talk about, in that article, of course, in Month Review, this kind of extract from the book ABCs of the Economic Crisis, What Working People Need to Know. You and Fred Magdoff, you know, make a list of ideas, of options, of things that folks can be raising questions about, creating options for. Talk about that a little bit. What is worth fighting for?
Well, I think the things that are most worth fighting for and that would have some possibility of achievement in the nearer term rather than when the whole system is dead are the things that give workers more security. I think that's a really important concept because the employing class wants us to be insecure, so that we'll take whatever they offer, so that we're afraid all the time. We're afraid we won't have enough to eat, like in that thing you mentioned at the beginning about food insecurity. We're afraid we'll get injured on the job. We're afraid we won't have health care. We're afraid to get old. Those are the kind of things that we need to start fighting for. We need to start the fight for food security for people. I don't care how you argue it. It's a human right. You're born. You should have enough to eat. You're born. You should have health care. You're born, you should have adequate housing. You're born, you shouldn't be pitched out onto the scrap heap when you're old. You shouldn't have to work till you're 90, which is probably coming soon enough. So all those are the places to start. Think about what makes you insecure and then say we shouldn't be insecure. We should be secure. And start from there and demand those as rights. And also, one of the jobs of economists is to point out that these things could be done
without such enormous expenditures of money, even as the economic bailout required. Food adequacy, adequate housing, and so on. Not only that, but they could be sort of self-financing in a way. You could train people to build the houses, which would give people a new skill set. They require, you know, in other words, once the government starts spending money on real output, it boosts up wages, the workers have more money to spend, and so on and so forth, a multiplier kind of effect. Instead of the money going to the rich, who then put it into the financial structure to make more money, generating a new bubble, which will probably be coming pretty soon. That's kind of the way I would look at it. Start out with the things that make the average person insecure and demand security as a right. Come hell or high water, you demand that. You say, this is my right as a human being to have these things. You have them, why shouldn't I have them?
Yes. As is so often the case, we're getting close to the end of the hour and the phone lines are backing up here. Let's go back to the phone lines. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Is that me?
It is.
Oh, yes. You know, I think one of the biggest obstacles to class awareness in this country is the race issue. And 45 years ago, Martin Luther King asked the question, you know, why aren't poor white people out here marching with us? Because, you know, their kids are going to suffer the same crappy health care and education. They wind up with the same crappy jobs as their parents. And yet, you know, it seems like it's such a divisive issue in this country. I mean, if we could only come to some agreement, some working relationship, so that we could realize that really, you know, class trumps, you know, our white hide or black hide or whatever.
No, I certainly agree with that, except today I would, you know, you got to talk about immigrants, I think, as well as, the classic white-black race issue. There, the labor movement has taken some progressive stands with respect to immigration, and even with respect to black and white equality. A lot more needs to be done. I mean, one of the first things that Trump ought to do is have some sort of summit on this, make policy statements, radical policy statements about the equality of all people, the rights of human beings. No one is illegal. That kind of thing as sort of an ideological starting point, and then go from there to the more practical aspects of bridging the gaps between white and black, between immigrant and non-immigrant, that kind of thing. It's important to do these things. It's important to get these things out on the table. It's important to start the argument at least, because the alternative is really a shift to the far right. That could happen in the United States. Don't kid yourself. I'm not one of these people that cries there's fascism on the horizon every time something happens. But on the other hand, this country's pretty far to the right as it is. And the failure, you know, the typical liberal failure that Obama embodies with respect to health care, with respect to war, with respect to the bailout of the bankers, this breeds anger, it breeds hostility. And that anger and hostility needs a way to think about things. It needs a progressive way to think about things. Because if it doesn't, it'll have a regressive way, because that's already there. And then there's real danger. Real danger, and that's the kind of thing that we want to avoid if we can.
256-2001. We have several people waiting to get in. I'm going to ask our remaining callers to please keep their comments and questions brief so that we can get everyone in. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm interested in the concept of the real economy. There's a website, realeconomy.com, Bob Rushline's website. But just the basic notion that we're moving away from manufacturing, we're moving away from what's creative in our economy and moving toward derivatives and all that. As you know, the progressive movement was sleeping when all these derivatives were being constructed and our economy was so distorted in that way. And I'd just like to hear the author's comments along those lines.
Real economy?
Well, I would say we're not moving towards that sort of thing. We're already there. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, we're already... That financialization of the economy has already happened, and things are only going to get they're only going to get worse, and that's of course the kind of thing that has to be reversed. And there's nothing that would prevent, say, communities at a local level from demanding some say about investment decisions in their communities, about how public funds are used, about how transfer payments from the federal government are used, about what happens to plants when they shut down. Why shouldn't the communities take over these auto plants to produce other things? That's the kind of argument that progressives need to make at a local level. And these automobile plants, for example, that are shutting their doors, and all these manufacturing plants that have shut their doors, they exist in communities. The capital is still there. And also, you had to get active right at the beginning to prevent companies from cannibalizing their plants, you know, taking the stuff out.
Right,
A lot of communities have paid good money to get those plants there in the first place. So the public ought to, the communities need to say, we should have a say about these things. This is the real economy that the caller's talking about. We have to produce things. There's a whole bunch of other kinds of arguments. We should be more secure in our food supply. We should have more local food production. There's no reason why cities can't. If Havana can produce a lot of food inside the city limits, then our cities could produce a lot of food inside the city limits. There's all kinds of things that could be done to stimulate the real and the local economy. Now, I'm not one of these people that says everything has to be local, because it can't be in the modern world. There has to be exchanges and movements of things from one place to another. And that's a complicated kind of issue. But she's right. The real economy has to be revitalized. But it has to be revitalized in a socially constructive way. The automobile industry provides a good example. There's lots of possibilities for the producing of public transportation, of more fuel-efficient vehicles and what have you. Communities have to have some say about that. The plants are there. The capacity is there. The workers are there. No reason why they can't be utilized. Argument, though. Real economy. That's a good phrase to keep hammering home. What about the real economy? What about real production? What about food, clothing, shelter? Why can't we make these things?
Michael Yates, toward the end of that article, recent article, that extract in Monthly Review, you and Fred Magdoff talk about mobilizations, getting people into motion to question what's going on, in the hopes of leading to a legitimation crisis. Talk about that.
Well, when you make demands to end security, when you make demands for the rebuilding of the real economy, these are not things that the system is very likely to tolerate. But if you stand fast and you say these things have to be done, then hopefully as mass groups like unions and the labor movement make these kinds of demands and the system cannot satisfy them, then people start to think the system is not legitimate, then they start to think of alternatives. That's the idea when I say a legitimization crisis. That the system isn't legitimate when it claims to be legitimate. If it can't meet the needs of its people, then it's not legitimate. And that's the kind of thought process you have. But a lot of things have to happen first, you know, before people are even aware or even thinking along those lines. And that's why when that caller talked about the real economy, that's a good concept to keep hammering home. The real production of things, not financial instruments. Financial instruments are worthless. They just make the rich people richer. They're not necessary. They're not necessary from society's point of view to have these things at all. They're only necessary within the framework of this society.
You know, again, I want to get back in and hone in a little bit on the, you know, we talked about the labor movement, of course, and you've raised criticism of Obama. But the function of the lack of vertebrae of the Democratic Party at this point, talk about that. That is, you know, Michael Moore points to it. How, you know, there's a kind of bipartisan plundering going on, and lots of folks here, you know, certainly in the labor movement, and lots of folks in a good whole liberal milieu in Madison, the Madison area, is wedded to the Democratic Party and hope for change from within. Your take on that?
No chance for change from within, none whatsoever, not from within the Democratic Party. It's thoroughly corrupted. It's just irritating to me in a way that Michael Moore, remember, he supported Wesley Clark for president, and then he's all gung-ho on Obama and what have you, and it's just a big fat waste of time. It's not to say that you can't get behind certain politicians if they have good ideas and try to get them elected so that they speak out about things. Like that fellow in Florida that was talking about health care. He says, you know, the Republicans' health plan is to die, for us to die. I thought that took a lot of courage and a lot of nerve. So anytime you can elect people like that, that's all to the good. But they have to be elected on the basis of their ideas. Wedding yourself to the Democratic Party is a big fat waste of time. It's a party of capital, just like the Republicans are a party of capital. Sometimes it's better than the Republicans. Some members within it are better than the Republicans. Some are not. I mean, wasn't it a Democrat that had put this abortion rider on the health plan? I believe it was. You know, with no funding for abortion. I mean, this is a perfectly legal thing. I can't even imagine that a health plan like that would be constitutional. I mean, I just can't even, but that was a Democrat that did that. You look at Charles Schumer, I mean, God, he reeks of corruption. All those top Democrats reek of corruption. Hillary Clinton reeks of corruption. I mean, they made $100 million since Bill Clinton left the White House. I wonder how they did that.
Nancy,
by being socially conscious.
You can
support individuals, but the main thing is you have to support a movement of ideas. I mentioned the labor movement. There are lots of other movements too. Immigrant movements, environmental movements, and so on, that all need to coalesce in one way or another. I guess that could start at the local level. A friend of mine lives in Toronto. That's one of the things he's working on, taking all these disparate groups, seeing what they have in common, see if you can bridge gaps and build some more coherent movement for social control of investment, for example.
Michael Yates, we have like a minute or two left. Some closing comments, thoughts?
Well, the first thing I wanted to say was that with respect, let me make a pitch. If you were selling that book really cheap, that ABCs of the Economic Crisis, it might be a good thing for study groups. If you buy five or more, you get a 30% discount. And so I have a number here, 800-670-9499. Ask for Scott at the monthly review office if you wanted to make any group orders of the book.
And of course,
I hate to be self-promoting, but listeners need to know that I make not a dime from this. So
okay, and of course, locally, Rainbow Bookstore has a number on order in prep
good.
For this. We've had you at the store, and we hope to have you.
I had a great experience at that store. Really great. I liked everybody. It was a big audience. You were very gracious. It was one of my best on my old long book tour. That was a highlight. My wife and I always talk about it. So
well, good. Michael Yates, I want to thank you for taking out time. I know you're busy. You keep cranking it out, and you've been great and an inspiration for lots of us. You've been listening this hour to Michael Yates, author of The ABCs of the Economic Crisis, What Working People Need to Know, among numerous other titles, Associate Editor of Monthly Review. I want to thank you, our listeners. I have a little something going on in my chest here today. But you, our listeners, our callers, Elizabeth, our engineer, Lucas out there on the phones answering. And, you know, tune in every other Thursday. Turn in every day at noon for a public affair, but every other Thursday for me. I've been your host this hour, Alan Ruff. Thank you for listening to WRT, and stay tuned for Democracy Now!
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. Listener-sponsored community radio and WORT HD.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Last Coast Producing, presenting Funk Out Cancer, a benefit for the UW-Carbone Cancer Center, Friday, November 20th at 8 p.m. at the Majestic Theater, featuring performances by Fat Function, Mama Dig Down's Brass Band, Mark Croft, and also a silent auction. Tickets available at MajesticMadison.com.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting on the road in Burbank, California.
Just now I had very good talks with President Obama. The two sides had in-depth exchange of views on how to further the bilateral relationship and on other major regional and international issues of shared interest.
When China rules the world, the end of the Western world and the birth of a new global order, we'll speak with British author and journalist Martin Jakes as President Obama wraps up his first official trip to China. Then Iraq's national elections are in question after the vice president vetoes the country's new election law. We'll speak with Iraqi blogger and analyst Raed Jarar. And finally, as Wall Street's on track to reap record profits this year, the Department of Agriculture reports 50 million Americans, including a quarter of all children, struggled to get enough to eat last year. We'll speak with veteran journalist Robert Scheer of TruthDig.com. He asked,
thank you for listening to this free program provided by WORT Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Become a listener sponsor. Donate to WORT online at WORTFM.org or call 608-256-2001 during business hours.